Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to another ChrisMartinson.com podcast. I am your host, of course, Chris Martinson. And today we have the good fortune of speaking with Alistair MacLeod, publisher of financeandeconomics.org and a recently introduced contributing editor to ChrisMartinson.com. I had the pleasure of meeting Alistair for the first time in Madrid, Spain, when he interviewed me. So we get to turn the tables here today and return the favor. Then we went out, he and I, to several extended meals over the next few days when I was over there in Spain, and I was really impressed with his ability to understand and articulate what's happening at the macroeconomic level globally. And given his vantage point from Europe, I'm keen on discussing his latest observations of where we are with the situation over there. The European sovereign debt crisis has been muted somewhat in the news lately, but it is by no means resolved and poses perhaps the greatest single risk today to global financial markets. And as we ponder which event might progress from the outside in to stir up another round of financial disruption, we'd do well to keep Europe in sharp focus. Alistair, a pleasure to have you.
Chris, it's very, very nice to speak to you again.
Well, wonderful. Can you give our listeners a quick sketch of your background, please?
Yes, certainly. I started off at the late age, of about 21 in the stock market. And I became a stockbroker, a member of the London Stock Exchange. I became senior partner of my firm at the grand age of about 29. And since then, I've not only been stockbroking, but also I've managed funds. I've been a director of a bank. I've done consultancy work for a wide range of financial services companies. So I come at it, if you like, from that end, rather than having gone to university, got a degree in economics, had to unlearn everything, and then start again. So I do have the advantage that I've been a practical economist, in inverted commas, as part of what I've been doing since my early 20s.
Well, that sets you very, very apart from your average central bank member, I would suggest.
It certainly does. And I learned very early on that, governments in particular, central banks also, really have very, very little clue of what goes on in the markets. It varies. I mean, some central bankers are better than others. But generally, things are driven, if you like, by political considerations rather than economic considerations, and that creates a certain tension in the markets.
And that's a really important point, which I hope to unravel here now. So you recently penned an excellent overview to the European credit crisis for our readers on ChrisMartinson.com. But for those who've yet to read it, can you summarize quickly for us how things got to this state?
Well, the history, I mean, this particular case goes back to the beginning of the euro, the birth of the euro, and you could argue it goes way back to the last war, really, when the European Iron and Steel Federation got together. The idea being, you know, if you got the disparate countries in Europe together politically, then they wouldn't fight each other in the future. And that gradually evolved over time to the point where they decided to go for the common currency, the euro, and that came in 1999. But ahead of that, the countries had to converge their economies so that they could stick together. Part of that convergence was the sort of European Monetary Union, whereby the various currencies would be stuck in a channel and managed so that they would work alongside each other, and that was meant to bring economic stability. Mm-hmm. And the other aspect of it was that these countries had to get economic convergence, and that meant things like levels of debt had to be within certain parameters, budget deficits had to be less than 3%. And so, as you may imagine, before the year of convergence, which was 1997, the countries going into the euro at that time fiddled the books quite a lot in order to qualify. And so we had a lot of, if you like, off-balance sheet stuff, which really dates all the way back to 1997, even though the euro came in 1999. And since then, virtually all the countries, with the exception of Luxembourg and I think Finland, have breached the rules by having too large a level of public sector debt, or indeed having too large a level of budget deficit. Mm-hmm. And the result of that is that instead of being fined, it was all just generally ignored. And once the euro got going, of course, that de-risked it from the bank's point of view, because they could then lend to countries like Spain or Italy. Greece joined later, so after they joined Greece, knowing that the rate of interest, let us say, on a bund, the German government bonds, was, say, 3%, and therefore, given that the whole system had a sort of guarantee, rather like a Fannie Mae guarantee, if you like, from the overall European Union, then you could effectively borrow at rates which equated to German government bond yields and lend it out to the Italians or the Spanish or the Greeks or the Portuguese for a spread of 2 or 3%, and you geared it up through fractional reserve banking. It was money for old rope. And the result was that there was a huge, great sea of bank credit created in the wake of the invention of the euro, even though the ECB itself ran a relatively tight monetary ship. So it was really a sea of credit, and that inevitably ended up with property bubbles, quite similar to the one you had in the United States. And when that burst, of course, the whole thing started falling apart. And of course, when the private sector starts going wrong and the banks come under huge, great pressure, inevitably, governments are asked to take up the running and guarantee the banks. And that's roughly where we got to, I think, in 2009. Since then, the crisis has been playing out because it is quite obvious that the weaker countries cannot support all this debt and implied off-balance sheet debt in the form of bank debt, various guarantees to nationalized industries, and so on and so forth. So it's a good old crisis which has got a lot of the mixture that we're familiar with in the United States and in the UK and perhaps even in Japan. But I think the reason it has become so much more obvious in Europe is because the individual national banks can't resort to quantitative easing to pay their government's bills. Mm-hmm. They actually have to go and borrow it. It's rather like they've got to go to the bank manager and convince the bank manager, if you like. And that is proving very, very tough. And that's roughly where we are. I don't know if that gives you enough of an overview, Chris.
Oh, that was an excellent summary. You know, I just recently interviewed Bill Black, former regulator over here in the States, and he said that the seeds of the subprime crisis were really just sown in regulatory failures that allowed certain behaviors to go forward. So I'm going to tie this in by suggesting that back in 1997, then in 1999, when the Union was coming together and forming and the euro was birthed, there were certain, let's say, structural conditions that were in play, right? Everybody had to sort of fit within these parameters, but they were allowed to fudge, in essence. I believe even Goldman Sachs got caught. I don't know what the summary of that was, but they were caught helping Greece hide certain debts off books so that their deficit ratios would look better than they actually were.
Absolutely true, yes.
Yeah, I'd like to hear more about that in a minute. But what I'm getting at here is that there was sort of this was almost designed to fail, if you will, in the sense that when you put in a structure that allows nation states to cheat and then gain access to cheap credit, what happens next really shouldn't surprise anybody, should it?
I agree with you entirely. I don't think I would say it was designed to fail. It was, if you like, designed with not enough attention being paid to how it would actually work going forward. And the reason for this is quite simple. You had all the politicians from the different countries all beating their own national political drum. And meanwhile, you had this sort of, the umbrella of the European Union, which everybody pays lip service to. But actually, they were pursuing their domestic agendas rather than working together at the European level. So it was never really going to work effectively. The politics of it were too divisive for the system to survive. I think that's the way I would put it.
No, I agree. Maybe I could have spoke more clearly, when I say designed to fail, it wasn't that people designed it saying, yeah, this is going to fail. But in its design, there were certainly risks of failure embedded.
It amounts to the same thing, effectively.
It does. It does, I guess, if we're being adults about this and can learn from past experience. So I'm really interested then in the political differences. You mentioned one. There's an extraordinary difference in how this all plays out because the local or regional banks, as they were, cannot just quantitative ease all on their own. I mean, Greece is certainly stuck with this. We contrast what's happening in Greece today with what's happening in Iceland, which did have the ability to ease, as it were, or debase its currency as a means of rectifying the imbalances, right? But Greece doesn't have that opportunity. So here we are, and I'd like, if you could, to explain really some of the politics that are involved in how the maneuvering happens or where it leads to types of sclerosis that prevent activities from happening that ought to be happening. But there's a very different political flavor and tenor, obviously, to what's happening with the ECB and then the member states in the EU as compared to, say, what's happening in Japan or in the United States.
Yeah. I think the overriding characteristic of politics in Europe is the shape of the parliaments. They are horseshoe shaped. By that I mean that you've got different degrees of opinion amongst generally disparate parties, and therefore governments are generally formed by coalition. Now what this means is that a dominant party who needs a smaller party to come on board will get that party on board by effectively bribing them. And if not actually bribing the individual politicians, which is the sort of thing that happened in Greece, the bribes would be in the form of, okay, well, we will introduce this tax or that tax, which suits your political platform. So you have this sort of constant shuffling of, trying to appease by bribes. And of course, the bribes are all paid effectively either out of taxes or in the old days before the euro, out of inflation. Once the euro came in, if you needed to raise some money to buy off a political party, then that was quite easy. It would be the Bank of France or, not the Bank of France, but BNP or, the Italian equivalent or the Spanish equivalent would come up with the money one way or the other to help the government in its efforts. So you have, on the domestic level, you do have this sort of political scene which really is fundamentally dishonest in the way it works. I don't mean that as a criticism, if you like, of the individuals. The individuals and their behavior, I think, is secondary to it. The order of events is if you've got a bad system, then you end up with bad people, and that's the way round it has really happened in Europe. At the European Union level, that has been a different problem. That has a separate parliament, as your listeners are undoubtedly aware. And that is the most extraordinary fudge. It sits part of the year in Strasbourg and part of the year in Brussels at great, great cost. The whole of the political machine migrates backwards and forwards. Uh-huh. And this is an example of the sort of political compromise that you get in the founding of an institution like the European Union. And what the European Union does is it has an unelected body, the commissioners, who will propose prospective legislation or regulations, and then that is put to the Parliament, and the Parliament either endorses it or throws it out. In practice, what happens is that the Parliament endorses it. And it has become, therefore, a huge, great machine for the production of regulations. I don't know, 9,000 regulations, I've heard that figure since mm-hmm. they started. It wouldn't surprise me if it was even double that. Mm-hmm. The result is that Europe has become a place where business can only operate if it is a friend of the government, if it manages to work its way around the taxes, if it manages to work its way around national prejudices, even though those are not meant to be there because the idea of the European Union is free trade. Alternatively, it's got to be able to comply with an absolutely extraordinary raft of anti-competitive regulations. So the whole system has really become pretty inefficient and works very much against free markets. So The only thing that has really been keeping it going, as I said, since the euro came in, was the expansion of bank credit. And, of course, that's the other aspect of it. The banks are really pretty political. They're very much in the hands of the politicians, and the politicians are very much in the banks' pockets. Might be familiar to your listeners in other jurisdictions as well.
Yes, we recognize that theme very well. And so here's what I'm interested in then. So this EU body has member representation. I want to understand the practical reality. So let's imagine I'm Spain for the moment. I'm Jean, and I have this extraordinary funding need. I maybe need 100 billion euros to get through the next funding cycle. How do I go about getting that? Is this an act of lobbying that happens at the EU level? Tell me the process.
Well, of course, there are two sorts of funding. There is a sort of funding which the EU can help with, and that is, let's say, regional subsidies of one form or another. So you get EU-funded infrastructure projects. That is about as far as the EU can really go. They spend most of their time demolishing markets rather than facilitating them. It's really predominantly a machine for the production of regulations, all obviously with the best intent, but very much with a political incentive in it as well. And a very good example of this is that the EU constantly tries to knock London as a financial centre off its perch. I think they're rather miffed, if you like, that the real market for dealing in euros happens to be based in London rather than anywhere in Europe like Frankfurt or Paris or wherever. And London keeps on trying to fight a rearguard action to stop this tide of regulation. And to a degree, they succeed. But you can see that the tensions are there the whole time. The other sort of funding, which is a major source of funding for a country like Spain, is really through the bond market and also through the banks. And the two things are obviously inextricably linked because most of the lending to the Spanish government tends to come from the Spanish banks. But if you go back to pre-crisis, particularly before the credit crisis of 2007-2008, then banks all around Europe were lending money to countries like Spain because, as I said earlier, they were picking up, if you like, on the interest rate differential between the bond yields in Germany and the bond yields in Spain. And the fact that there were only about 1 or 2% difference just basically meant that all a bank did was it geared it up even more so that it was effectively doing a reverse repo. It would gear up that 1 or 2% differential and walk away with 20% per annum for doing nothing. It really was money for a rope. And, of course, countries like Spain became completely dependent on financing of this sort.
All right, so I'm Spain, and I'm obviously relying on the bond market. I've spent wildly beyond my means for a period of time. It was credit, and like all good credit bubbles, they come to an end. And as the Austrians say, your choices include either the voluntary abandonment of your credit cycle or the destruction of your currency. Neither of those actually seem to be an option for Spain, so they seem to be stuck in some sort of a netherworld in this moment, and so they have to rely on the bond market. One of the things that's certainly become quite obvious is that the ECB is stepping into bond markets quite often, routinely, at the Italian auctions, also the open market, Spanish auctions and open market. In your estimation, if we were to speculate a bit, are there people in the ECB who are tasked with watching these bond markets, and do you think they have marching orders, as it were, to maintain price levels and or market stability and liquidity?
Well, the ECB obviously watches the bond markets extremely closely. I think if I can just take a step back in your analysis, the ECB really, I think, has one overriding problem. And that is in the context that individual nations are effectively standing behind their banks, the ECB has an overall responsibility for the European banking system. And therefore, its primary focus is to keep the banking system from hitting a banking crisis. So and that's the basis behind all these long-term financing, the LTRO financing, which has, I think, run to pretty well a trillion euros now, mm-hmm. And that is to support the banks. But what the banks are doing is they take some of that capital and they put it aside because they've got their own bond redemptions, which they've got to meet in their own balance sheet, and they can't see who's going to lend them the money at this stage. They've also got deposits walking out of the door and going to other banks within the euro system, so they need to reserve something back from there. But once they've made that estimation, they have something left over which they can lend to their governments. So it was never the intention of the ECB to bail out the governments. But what we did see, obviously, is, as you referred to, the yields of the bonds for the Spanish government and the Italian government fell really quite sharply as these long-term financing operations were put in place by the ECB, suggesting there was big leakage going into financing those governments. And now that is over, the yields are beginning to rise again. But I think that if the ECB is going to succeed in its mandate of supporting the banking system and stopping that falling over, it really cannot bail out the governments as well. So it's got this sort of, it's stuck in a sense. It's got to concentrate on what it's got to do. But equally, if the governments get into real difficulties, it's going to make it difficult, even more difficult, for the ECB to stop certain parts of the bank of the European banking system failing. So it's, you know, they're damned if they do and they're damned if they don't. Now, I think under Trichet, who was the previous chairman of the ECB or president of the ECB, he took quite a hard line, and he recognized quite clearly that he has to keep the banking system going, and he's not going to make money available for the governments. Now, when he retired, I think Draghi has taken the softer line, and he has condoned, if I can put it that way, two things. Firstly, national banks lending to their governments and taking money up to 3 years maturity from the ECB in order to do so. So that is, if you like, a sort of a temporary fix for governments in difficulty. And the second thing is that he's turned a blind eye to the imbalances that have built up in the central banks, in the national central banks, interbanking settlement system, which is called TARGET. Now, I haven't referred to this in this interview, but this is actually very important because at the moment it has built up huge, huge imbalances which explain why the bank runs that we have seen in Greece in particular, Spain, Portugal, and Italy, have not produced the sort of bank run crisis on the surface which we're familiar with. And the reason for it is the way the settlement system works. So if I can just explain this to you, Chris.
Please do.
For your listeners.
Yes.
It's slightly technical, but I'll try and keep it as simple as possible. Let us assume that a tour operator in Greece wants to order some Mercedes buses. He will buy those buses from Mercedes-Benz in Stuttgart, which is fine, and he will pay Mercedes-Benz in Stuttgart. Now, in the process, what he has done is he has taken the euros away from the Greek economy and moved them into the German economy. Now, this is balanced by the central banks, the national central banks, and in this case, the National Bank of Greece will issue sufficient euros to replace the ones that have left the country, so there is no net monetary effect. And the Bundesbank will withdraw euros from circulation for the same reason, to keep the level of euros in Germany stable, notwithstanding the fact that Mercedes has suddenly managed to get hold of a whole load of euros as a consequence of selling buses to Greece. Now, within the books of the central banks, this is balanced out by a loan that appears in their books to the effect that the Bundesbank has a loan due to it for those euros from the Bank of Greece. And in the Bank of Greece's books, it has an obligation, a loan, to pay the Bundesbank. So that balances out. Now, the effect is that an imbalance arises across the central banks. And in this case, the cost of the buses, suddenly, you have got money owed by Greece to the Bundesbank. Now, normally, over time, you would expect these things to balance out, because capital flows will be going one way, while trade flows go the other way.
Mm-hmm.
But since you've also had not only the trade flows going in whichever way they go, but you've had capital flight, this has led to a huge rate imbalance across the national central bank's books. And it's got to the point now where I think the most recent figures for the Bundesbank indicate that it is owed getting on for 700 billion euros by the other national central banks. And obviously, this is not just Greece. It's Greece, it's Portugal, it's Ireland, it's Spain, it's Italy, it's France, and so on and so forth. The only central banks which have loans owed to them on a net basis, and remember, this is a net basis because it's a, you know, it's a complete sort of settlement system we're talking about, are the Bundesbank. You've got the Netherlands Central Bank, and also Luxembourg.
Hmm.
And I think Finland are just about in balance. But that is it. So the reason that the system hasn't fallen over is because the ECB has turned a blind eye, if you like, to this development. And this is the sort of imbalance. These are the sort of problems that we have in the background. Now, none of us would have known about this if it hadn't been for a research paper that was produced by the IFO Institute in Munich, I think it is, going into this sort of very arcane, boring subject. And it has now become quite an issue in Germany. And the German people are beginning to sort of think, now, hold on a minute. Our central bank here is owed a heck of a lot of money by all these other central banks. Are they ever going to get repaid? So you can see that it is now becoming politicized. So that's sort of roughly where we are, if you like, on the where the central banks are and what they're trying to do. And what I would contend is that if the ECB tried to get into the business of supporting government finances as well, or overtly supporting government finances, then I think it wouldn't be very quick before it would be game over for the euro. But so far they are resisting that. They are doing it, if you like, under the counter.
Great. I want to talk about that a little bit later. Right now I'm interested in, you know, maybe 6 months ago, I'm guessing here, the BBC had this really nice interactive chart, which was a circle, and it showed these arrow flows of who owed who what. And you don't have to click around the circle very many times to see that, you know, with Ireland owing all these countries, and then Spain owing all these countries, and France owing all these countries, and the U.S. owing all these countries, that everybody owes everybody. And
yes, well, it's more than that, Chris. It's really the private sector banking system that owes these things. So, you know, you've got, for example, you've got French banks owning Spanish bonds, Spanish banks owning Irish bonds, German banks owning Irish bonds, and so on. So it's really government bonds being held within the private sector banking system.
Right, and you've just described a second device in this target system, which sounds to me a lot like a current account imbalance, but within a single currency. And so that's a sort of an official set of imbalances that exists. So here we have, fundamentally, you know, this was a predicament of insolvency. And of course, predictably, you know, the ECB has a mandate. It's to protect a banking system. The way you do that is you provide liquidity. They've done that in ample amounts. But liquidity, insolvency, two very different concepts often, usually. And so here we are at this moment where, you know, if you have a mental image, maybe it's of fingers being put into a dike with leaks coming out, right? And so they're limping this along. But at the fundamental level, in terms of what really needs to happen, there is some sort of an adjustment process that has to happen. So step forward, it turns out that a number of countries are being rather unwillingly, I would suggest, nudged towards the idea of austerity, Greece being the first candidate or victim, and Spain pretty far along that trail. And of course, lo and behold, it turns out austerity in a time of excessive government expenditures leads to economic contraction, which only adds another set of pressures to an outstanding pile of debt and indebtedness. So taking all of this into account, seeing where we are in this landscape, what if there was going to be some sort of a resolution to this that was going to work? What would that look like? Is it austerity? Is it just more printing? What if any resolution exists here?
I like your use of the little word if. The problem is even, I'm afraid, it's even more complex and deeper than you, than we have discussed so far. There is one big element of this which nobody has addressed because they don't understand it. If you're an Austrian economist, you will understand it. If you're not, you won't. And because governments are populated by economists who are not Austrian, then they don't understand it, and they won't understand it. And that is this. If you try and measure an economy by GDP, all you are measuring at the end of the day is the amount of money in the economy. It is not a measure of economic progress. Now, this is a very, very important point. And the reason it is relevant is that so long as you say we need GDP to not fall, mm-hmm. which is roughly what we're talking about as far as the problem that the officials see, they don't want the economy to fall because it threatens taxes and all the rest of it. If they're measuring it by GDP, then they are using the wrong metric to come up with any solution. Does that make sense?
Well, it does, because one of the things I've harped on continuously is that with GDP, if a country goes deeper and deeper into debt to fund itself, GDP only measures the so-called economic activity that happens as a result. It doesn't measure the offsetting debt. And if you strip out the debt effect, you will find that many economies have actually, in fact, not been growing, rather at all. And so it's
precisely.
we're measuring something that is illusory because it provides a gain when it's there, but it's going to do the opposite when it's not there.
Yeah, it is in effect no more than an accounting identity.
Right.
Now we're in the real world and we're trying to seek a solution to the problem. And you don't do that by concentrating on an accounting identity. And this is the point that nobody in the system seems to understand. And so far as I'm aware, nobody is yet discussing. But this is why I think virtually anything that they do is almost certain to fail. Now, if we take a step back, the one thing that is wrong with the European Union, and most of the other advanced nations, by the way, it's not just them, is the size of government. There is the myth that government can intervene and improve things. It can't. As you rightly point out, one side that isn't looked at is that government spends money on subsidizing this industry, paying out welfare and so on and so forth, but that money's got to come from somewhere. It is being taken away from the productive economy and being injected into something less productive or not productive at all. They're destroying savings and therefore the ability of an economy to actually progress itself. And so, but at the accounting identity level, governments can do this and actually push up GDP, because GDP incorporates government spending at cost, the provision of mm-hmm. of services and all the rest of it. That is part of GDP. So if government increases its spending, GDP goes up. I mean, but as you rightly say, it excludes the other side, and that is, where does the money actually come from?
Right.
So we actually do have a huge problem in understanding what the problem is and therefore how to resolve it. I think that the consequence of that is that the crisis is likely to drag out a lot longer than it would otherwise, because they are bound to resist the obvious, and that is to cut government spending. You really need to slash it the whole way across the board. They will resist that because the economists will tell them, and by this I mean the neoclassical economists, that if you cut spending across the board, then you're going to cut GDP, which means that your tax take is going to go down, and you're just going to make the problem worse.
Mm-hmm.
And you unless you print money to offset it, you're going to produce a huge, great deflation. But actually, what they need to do is to cut the government spending, remove the distortions from the economy, so that the economy can actually recover itself. Now, you mentioned Iceland earlier. Iceland, I think, you know, that what the currency did is a slightly separate thing from what happened in Iceland itself. The government hadn't resources to do anything. It couldn't interfere. It just stood back, and everybody understood, we've got a problem. It's a huge, great problem. Somehow, we've got to look after ourselves. We can't expect the government to pay our welfare, pay for this, pay for that. We've got to look after ourselves. They've done that, and the result is the economy has turned round. That is what we need to happen in Europe. But they are going to resist that process to the politicians' dying days. And that is really the problem. They're now getting in the way of the solution.
So what you've described is really that there was a sort of a structural risk that was embedded in this entire construct starting back in 1997. It was exploited for temporal gain, and it worked really well while it worked. As long as the pie was expanding and nobody was looking too carefully at the mounting imbalances, it chugged along beautifully. Everybody was getting rich on their Spanish villas going up in price almost daily. And this whole thing was bound to work until mathematically it couldn't work. And just leaving out of this story the impact of rising energy costs, which is a big component I usually weave in at this moment, just all on its own, this was bound to have a mathematical problem. It's encountered that mathematical sort of limit, as it were. You know, obviously, it could have limped along further, but for one set of reasons and another, it ended. And instead of saying, wow, that's over, how did we go wrong, where shall we repair this, the very natural systemic response is to perpetuate the status quo. Let's get this through the next quarter. Let's get it through the next election cycle. Let's see if we can keep the bond markets alive another week, whatever those things are that we're all looking at. And so you've painted a picture for me of a whole lot of very well-meaning, very interested people who are diligently applying the wrong solutions to the incorrect diagnosis.
I think you've summed it up extremely well.
Well, thank you for that. And so with that excellent summary, I want to we're going to end this part of the interview, and we're going to move on to part two for the enrolled members. And I want to get in that part very specifically what the key risks are, what the scenarios might look like as this plays out, because it has more room to play out here. And I want to talk about specifically what individuals can do in that circumstance, specifically for those of us who live in Europe who are listening to this, and as well maybe generally on the globe. So with that ending, can you tell people who are interested in following you more closely, besides the articles you write for chrismartinson.com, where would they do that?
Well, I have a website, which is financeandeconomics.org, all one word with a stop before the org. And I also write for Gold Money. And I speak, you know, I go around and speak at various conferences and so on and so forth. But my writings can be found really on those two sites. I tend to put the longer articles on financeandeconomics.org. Gold Money's clients like a sort of 500-word thing. So I try and, on that one, do sort of fairly straightforward subject, because 500 words doesn't give you a lot to develop something which can really be understood. But those are the two sites where you will generally find me.
Wonderful. Well, this is Chris Martinson. We've been talking with Alistair MacLeod, and you can find out more either at chrismartinson.com or financeandeconomics.org.